process the rape. She became promiscuous for a few years, until she met a guy named Chip Hofstadter, who owned a fish store in Queens. They married 8 months later when Rebecca was 4, because Brenda needed a way out of her parents' apartment, and Chip was willing to be a father to Rebecca. They had 2 more children, and all 3 grew up believing that Chip was their father. Brenda and Chip separated when Rebecca was 15, and one of Brenda's subsequent boyfriends raped Rebecca. Brenda decided it was time to tell Rebecca about her own rape. It wasn't good for her to live with lies anymore, she explained to me. Rebecca was furious and grew increasingly rebellious. She became pregnant by her first boyfriend, and Brenda became a grandmother at 35. 2 years later, Rebecca had another child by another father. When Rebecca became pregnant with her 3rd by yet another man, Brenda took her for an abortion, saying, "You're ruining your life, and I can't let you do this. I'll probably burn in hell for it, but there comes a time when I have to step in." Rebecca eventually joined the Air Force. When I first met Brenda, Rebecca was stationed in Iraq, and Brenda was raising Rebecca's 2 children. "My grandchildren are my heartbeat," Brenda said. "I didn't think that I could love like that, and I didn't love like that with my own children. Maybe I was too young, maybe the rape. But when I felt that love, I had to let the rape go. I've asked myself, if I ever saw my attackers in the street, would I recognize them? The shadowy faces I visualized could be anyone. I depersonalized it. The rape was there, but it was an act, not people. All I know is I have something that these people will never know. Never know that they have a beautiful daughter. Never know that they have beautiful grandchildren. They'll never know. But I do. And so, as it turns out, I'm the lucky one." American abortion law from the colonial period through the mid-19th century was predicated on the English common law principle that life begins with quickening, the moment when the expectant woman feels the fetus moving inside her, usually at 4 to 5 months. In 1857, the newly formed American Medical Association began a crusade against abortion even prior to quickening, and laws passed in 1860 and 1880 made abortion illegal at any stage unless the mother's life was at risk. In 1904, the Journal of the AMA concluded that pregnancy is rare after real rape, and that, regardless, the fetus's rights trump the mother's, as the enormity of the crime of rape does not justify murder. The 1930s saw a rise in illegal abortions as the Great Depression made large families harder to sustain. Many women died as a result of backroom operations by untrained practitioners. In 1936, Frederick J. Taussig, an influential physician, sought to make abortion available to women who deserved it without aiding those who might abuse the right, worrying that abortions for unmarried women or widows would result in a lowering of the moral tone. He proposed a law, never implemented but highly influential, that would permit abortions for rape victims, mentally retarded women, girls under 16, and any poorly nourished woman with a large family whose external conditions make the pregnancy and the subsequent care of the child a serious burden. In 1938, a physician was put on trial in England for performing an abortion on a 14-year-old rape victim, and his acquittal reflected a populist movement to liberalize the right to abortion, especially for rape victims. The trial was widely covered in the United States and led to open discussion of abortion. In 1939, The first U.S. hospital abortion committee was formed to determine case-by-case eligibility, and by the 1950s, such committees were ubiquitous. They approved only therapeutic abortions, those intended to preserve the mother's health or to avoid the birth of a child with significant disabilities. Increasingly, however, they accepted the recommendations of psychiatrists who stated that a patient's pregnancy was endangering her mental health. Well-connected women could obtain psychiatric diagnoses fairly easily, but rape victims who could not pay a psychiatrist to vouch for their mental frailty had to show that they were nearly deranged. Some were diagnosed as licentious and had to consent to sterilization. So, contrary to Taussig's proposal, abortions became the province of the privileged. Here is a typical caseworker report about a woman raped in the post-war era. She became a passive object and could not say no. Here we see a girl who, having lost parental love, continues to search for love, and her primary motivation became centered in getting her dependent needs met. The clear implication is that mentally stable women do not get raped. In 1959, the American Law Institute, ALI, proposed legalizing abortion if the pregnancy was the result of rape or incest, the fetus had severe abnormalities, or the mother's health was at risk. In 1960, Illinois made abortion legal in cases of rape. And over the next decade, a dozen states passed laws based on the ALI model. Nonetheless, the standard treatment in most states for unwed women who had been raped was to send them to maternity homes, where they were encouraged to surrender their children for adoption. They were told this would be better for the baby than a life of shame with an unwed mother. Women who wanted to abort were considered murderous. Women who wanted to keep their children, selfish. Coerced relinquishments were common. Ricky Solinger, who has studied these surrenders, describes Kathleen Leahy Koch, date-raped in 1969, who complained that she was treated like a criminal, saying, "I was just someone who had to have a baby for some worthy family. It was completely dehumanizing." Another woman, Kay Ball, raped and pregnant in 1971, attempted suicide after surrendering her baby. She said, "I was so ashamed and beaten down emotionally and mentally that I just wanted to end it all." In 1973, the Supreme Court affirmed a woman's right to an abortion in Roe v. Wade. In 1976, the Hyde Amendment cut off Medicaid funding for abortion, except when the mother's health was at risk. And not until 1993 was a further exception made for women pregnant through rape or incest. Since 1973, the issue of rape has arisen in every legislative attempt to curtail or strengthen the freedoms established under Roe v. Wade. While abortion of fetuses with disabilities is often constructed as saving the putative child from suffering, the rape exception is held to be about saving the mother. By the late 1980s, polls showed that while half of Americans opposed abortions for most women, only a small percentage opposed abortion for rape and incest victims. A number of abortion bans without rape exceptions were struck down. In 1990, Idaho Governor Cecil D. Andrus, who opposed abortion in most contexts, vetoed a ban because under it a rape survivor seeking an abortion ceases to be the victim and becomes a criminal. In some instances, abortion opponents have agreed to rape exceptions on grounds that the pregnant women are innocent, unlike those who become pregnant because of their untrammeled passions. The anti-abortion movement argues that an unborn child is innocent even in cases of rape. One advocate wrote, "It would be wrong to deprive the child of his unalienable right to life and the due process of the law because of the sins of his father. Two wrongs do not make a right. The mother of a rape-conceived child said, "My child is not the exception that can be tossed away. There would be no one who could look her in the eyes and believe that she doesn't deserve life due to the choice of a man we never even knew." Some believe that pregnancy is a manifestation of God's will, quoting Jeremiah 1:5, which says, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you." This passage is taken to mean that life exists even before conception. Many hardline anti-abortion activists claim to support the best interests of the mother, taking the position that there can be no feeling of empowerment in a decision to abort. J.C. Wilk, founder of the International Right to Life Federation, said, "The woman has been subjected to an ugly trauma. Should we now ask her to be a party to a second violent act, that of abortion?" Rebecca Kiesling's pamphlet, Conceived in Rape, A Story of Hope, includes the assertion, "I am not a product of rape, but a child of God." A blogger wrote in sarcastic response, "Rape isn't abuse. It's another form of the Immaculate Conception." As with all contentious public issues, both sides look to selective statistics and dramatic personal stories to bolster their positions. The crucial difference is that the pro-choice movement is not, as Wilk suggests, asking a woman to abort, but the Right to Life movement is attempting to force all pregnant rape victims to carry their fetuses to term. The British psychoanalyst Joan Raphael Leff writes that a rape-conceived fetus may remain an internal foreigner, barely tolerated or in constant danger of expulsion, and the baby will emerge part stranger, likely to be ostracized or punished. One rape survivor, in testimony before the Louisiana Senate Committee on Health and Welfare, likened her son to "a living, breathing torture mechanism that replayed in my mind over and over the rape." Another described mothering a rape-conceived son as "entrapment beyond description," and felt that the child was cursed from birth. Her son manifested severe psychological challenges and was ultimately removed from the family by social services. Joan Kemp sees abortion as a solution imposed by a society that places too much importance on male lineage and not enough on the value of each human being. In that regard, she categorizes the pro-choice movement as anti-feminist. Some women who become pregnant after rape refer to the ensuing childbirth as a second rape. Anti-abortion feminists refer to the abortions that such women may choose to have as the second rape. For some women, an abortion might be more traumatic than bearing a rape-conceived child. The pseudonymous Denise Kolaski writes of how she was put under involuntary anesthesia for the abortion of the pregnancy that began when her father raped her, so her parents could keep their reputations intact. Here, the abortion clearly constitutes another assault, characterized by lack of choice. Among those who would block the right of rape victims to choice, none is more determined than David C. Reardon, founder of the Elliott Institute. There is no eponymous Elliott. The Institute's website explains that the name was selected to sound official and impartial. Starting in the early 1980s, some pro-life advocates opposed abortion even for a rape victim on the basis that it could lead to a condition they named post-abortion syndrome, characterized by depression, regret, and suicidality, a condition formulated as evidence that the Supreme Court had been wrong in Roe v. Wade when it averred that abortion was a safe procedure. The ultimate goal of the Elliott Institute is to generate legislation that would allow a woman to seek civil damages against a physician who has damaged her mental health by providing her with an elective abortion. on the topic of impregnated survivors of rape and incest, Reardon states in his book, Victims and Victors, many women report that their abortions felt like a degrading form of medical rape. Abortion involves a painful intrusion into a woman's sexual organs by a masked stranger. He and other anti-abortion partisans often quote the essay Pregnancy and Sexual Assault by Sandra K. Maycorn, who suggests that the emotional and psychological burdens of pregnancy resulting from rape can be lessened with proper support. Another activist, George E. Maloof, writes, incestuous pregnancy offers a ray of generosity to the world, a new life. To snuff it out by abortion is to compound the sexual child abuse with physical child abuse. We may expect a suicide to follow abortion as the quick and easy way to solving personal problems. Younger women and girls who don't have a clear idea of their own future often decide to continue or end a rape-related pregnancy in rebellion against or compliance with the wishes of parents and other elders. Other women are in denial. 1/3 of pregnancies resulting from rape are not discovered until the second trimester. Any delay in detection or action reduces women's options, but many women are still recovering from being raped when they are called on to make up their minds whether to carry through their pregnancy. No matter which choice is ultimately made, pregnancy after rape can lead to depression, anxiety, insomnia, and PTSD. Rape is a permanent damage. It leaves not scars, but open wounds. As one woman I interviewed said, you can abort the child, but not the experience. The philosopher Susan Bryson, herself a rape survivor, has said, trauma not only haunts the conscious and unconscious mind, but also remains in the body, in each of the senses, ready to resurface whenever something triggers a reliving of the traumatic event. A pregnancy literalizes this condition by staying in the body until abortion or delivery. In describing the problems of treating raped women, Croatian psychiatry professor Vera Folnegovic-Smalk said, we frequently encounter a loss of vital instincts or even a death wish. Suicidal thoughts are evident above all. Melinda Stevenson knew from childhood that she wanted to go into deaf education. Her father was deaf, and her mother hearing. As a hearing child, fluent in sign, she served as her father's translator. He had completed only fifth grade, and her mother had graduated from high school. Melinda was determined to go to college. In her native Indiana, Ball State University was the only college that gave degrees in deaf education, so that's where Melinda went. In her sophomore year, she lived off campus and commuted via the university-run shuttle service. The shuttles were driven by students, and Melinda occasionally chatted with them, including one, Ricky, who was a childhood education major. One evening on her way home, Melinda noticed a car idling in front of her building. She assumed it was someone dropping off her roommate, who usually returned from volleyball practice about that time, so she left the door unlocked. When she heard it close, she turned and saw Ricky. He shoved me on the bed and said, if you scream, I will kill you. I remember looking at my clock. It was 8:47. The phone was ringing. She found out later that her mother was calling, but he cut the cord. I was banging on the wall. I was kicking him, but then he showed me a knife, and I wanted to live. He left at 11:23. Melinda sat on her bed without moving until 5:30 the next morning, when she finally asked a friend to take her to the hospital. The nurse expressed doubt that it had been a rape and did not offer emergency contraception. She did, however, summon the police, and Melinda made a report. The police asked if she wanted to press charges, and she said she couldn't. Melinda finished the fall semester with plummeting grades and dropped out halfway through the spring semester, paralyzed by anxiety. "I was petrified to leave my apartment," she recalled. She moved back in with her parents and enrolled at Ivy Tech Community College, although it had no deaf education program. When she realized she was pregnant and told her mother, it was already too late for an abortion. Melinda couldn't bear the thought of relinquishing the baby anyway. "I had to change and adapt, or be stuck in fear," she explained. "So I changed, and I adapted." Many of the adaptations were painful. Anxious and deeply depressed, she was hospitalized twice, once on suicide watch. She was offered a job in deaf education out of state, but was terrified to live on her own. When her son, Marcus, was born, Melinda's parents refused to treat him as their grandchild. "We have a secured area in the living room where we stay," Melinda explained. "When her father is home, Marcus has to stay within 5 feet of her. Marcus went to touch the TV the other day," she said, "and my dad went to hit him, and I yelled, 'You touch him, and you'll never see me again.'" When her sister adopted a daughter, Melinda's parents would take the little girl to the park and go to grandparents' day at her school. But when a co-worker asked Melinda's mother how her grandson was doing, she said, "What grandson? I don't have a grandson." After college, Melinda got a job with Head Start. By then she had developed compulsions, could not tolerate having different foods touch, began cutting herself, and couldn't go to a new place on her own, even a Starbucks. "If you get into my bubble," she warned, "I get angry." A child at Head Start wore a stocking cap one day that was identical to Ricky's, and she took it out of his cubby and threw it away. "He was 4 years old. I've got to fix this," she said. Melinda started seeing a therapist who was a rape survivor herself. At first, Melinda couldn't talk about what had happened. When she did, she insisted that the door be locked first. Her therapist suggested that Melinda send anonymous postcards to Ricky, laying out her accusations as a way of getting it off her chest. She sent one every other day, from different towns. Sometimes she would print them out on a computer. Other times she'd paste together words she'd cut out of magazines, or imitate a child's handwriting. She mailed some to his job, others to his home. After 6 months of postcards, Ricky brought charges against her for stalking, so she was fired from Head Start, where employees cannot be the subject of a criminal investigation. "I've worked at a job for 2 years. I've never been in trouble. I've never been late. I've never missed a day. Nothing. And you're going to fire me over a postcard?" she said. Ricky then announced that he was going to sue for custody, and Melinda broke down. She took Marcus to Child Protective Services, CPS, and announced that she was signing him over. Her therapist met her there and convinced her to take Marcus home, but her mother offered to drive her back to CPS if she changed her mind again. Melinda found another job in a toddler daycare center. Her mental state remained fragile, and the line between Marcus and Ricky seemed blurred for her. "I feel like they're connected, and there's no one or the other," she said. "He'll touch me and say something, and I'll think, 'That's your dad.' What if I go to hurt him, thinking he's his dad? I'm petrified. Marcus is the spitting image of my rapist." She got a glazed look. "There's some things that he does, and I'll think, 'Oh, I'm so proud of you.' And then he'll talk to me, and suddenly, I can't even acknowledge him. Without him, what's going to make me get up in the morning? I guess I'm much less likely to kill myself if I've got him. Within a year, Melinda wrote to me that she'd been dating a man for 8 months and they were expecting a child. Marcus is excited about being a big brother, she continued. I am happy, therapy is going in a good path, and the best part, my parents can't tell us what to do anymore. 2 months later, she wrote, the guy I had been dating decided that I wasn't for him. He is now living in Michigan with his new wife. I named my daughter Eliza. Sad news is, she was born dead. My pregnancy with her was so different than with Marcus. With Eliza, I made sure that everything I did was in the best interest of Eliza. Kinda odd, huh? Wanted to ignore Marcus and hope it would go away, and I have him. And then I do everything I can to take care of myself and my Eliza, and I lose her. 6 months later, she gave up Marcus. He was placed with a foster family that was considering adopting him. I see him as much as I want, Melinda wrote, which is not as much as I should. He is getting everything that I could not provide. I am not allowed to spend time alone with him, and I think that is very smart. I struggle a lot with losing Eliza. For Eliza's birthday, I am having a cookout with some friends. I am so excited to make her gunk cake. It's a 9x11 yellow cake with peanut butter icing covered in birdseed, with whatever writing I decide to put on it. I will be putting this cake on her grave, so that the wildlife can enjoy her presence and life as all of us do every day. So Melinda struggled on, in love with a child who was dead, and unable to love the one who was alive. Rape engenders both rage and sadness, and even as it had made Marcus the object of Melinda's displaced fury, it had made Eliza the safer receptacle of her despair. Recent theorists have applied evolutionary theory to surmise that rape is primarily a reproductive strategy, the genes for which are likely to be selected. Jonathan and Tiffany Gottschall, who teach at Washington and Jefferson College, propose that rapists target victims not only on the basis of age, but based on a whole complement of physical and behavioral signals indicating a victim's capacity to become pregnant, many of them the same signals that underlie non-rape attraction. Randy Thornhill and Craig T. Palmer, authors of A Natural History of Rape, argue that men who commit rape spread their seed far and wide, thus fulfilling the self-perpetuating drive of the selfish gene. The idea that fantasies of forced reproduction often course through the minds of rapists accords with feminist theory. The scholar Catherine MacKinnon has emphasized this construct, writing, "Forced pregnancy is familiar, beginning in rape and proceeding through the denial of abortions. This occurred during slavery, and still happens to women who cannot afford abortions." Susan Brown Miller has proposed that reproduction is the primary motive for many rapists. Men began to rape women when they discovered that sexual intercourse led to pregnancy, she writes. In the developed world, rape may be an effective reproductive strategy within abusive relationships, but hardly otherwise. Most victims do not become pregnant, most of those who do have abortions, and rapists are sometimes imprisoned, curtailing their reproductive potential. Mary P. Koss, a clinical psychologist at the Arizona College of Public Health who studies sexual violence, has said that rather than choosing between evolutionary and social explanations for rape, we must figure out how to integrate them. Rapists are often repeat offenders. It is less well known that women who have been raped before age 18 are twice as likely as other women to be raped as adults. Sexual abuse perpetuates itself. The two statistics have an appalling symmetry. As aggression is rewarded in the rapist, the victim's ego becomes frayed and vulnerable. Then her understanding that the world is unsafe becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Growing up in Milwaukee, Lori Michaels had a friendly relationship with Fred Hughes, who lived across the street with his wife and three kids. When Lori was 12, Fred started buying her candy and taking her for rides in his car. After he'd built up some trust, he took her to a garage, put a 9mm gun to her head, and made her perform oral sex on him. It happened 4 times over a couple of months. Then Fred and his family moved to Chicago. She never told anyone. When Lori was 19, Fred moved back to Milwaukee. Lori was staying with someone who knew him, and sometimes she would wake up at night to find Fred in her room with his gun. He would take her back to the same garage, time and again for more than a year. Lori kept quiet about it. She feared what her mother, Clarabelle, might say if she found out. One night, her landlord's sister said, "Lori, Fred's been bragging about sleeping with you. Was that willingly?" Lori said it was not. "I didn't think so," came the response. "He did it to my daughter Ginger, too." Ginger was 14 at the time. Ginger's mother called the police on Lori's behalf, and Lori took them to the garage. Ginger had already led them to the same place. "Who knows who else he was hitting up?" Lori remarked. Not long afterward, Lori realized she was pregnant. She told her boyfriend, Bud, that he or Fred could be the father. Fred was black, and Lori and Bud were white, so she figured she would find out when the child was born. When Clarabelle got wind of what had happened, the harsh judgment Lori feared didn't materialize. "Are you going to get an abortion? Put it up for adoption? Keep it?" Clarabelle asked. "If you keep the child, you can't take anything out on that child. And if you're not going to keep it, it's best to make a clean break and be done with it immediately." Clarabelle listed the problems Lori would face, starting with racism if it was Fred's, and said it was hard work being a single mother. After a day of pondering, Lori told Clarabelle she was going to keep the child, and her mother said, "I knew you would. I just wanted you to think before you made that choice." Lori moved back home, but she sank into depression and slit her wrists when she was 8 months pregnant. Bud found her and called 911. Lori insisted that the rape, not the pregnancy, had engendered her despair, and that if she hadn't been pregnant, her suicide attempt would have been successful. "My son is what kept me going," she said, echoing a frequent refrain among mothers of such children. That Lori had put up with years of rape without a suicide attempt, and then made one during pregnancy, called her logic into question. "When the boy was born, he looked white. And then when I went to change his diaper, his penis was black," Lori said. "So they told me, mulatto babies come out white and their penises are black." Lori named him Bobby, and took him home, where Clarabelle did much of the caretaking. Fred was prosecuted for his rapes of Lori and Ginger. Sentenced to 2.5 years, he was released after 2 years for good behavior. Genetic analysis showed that Bobby was his son, and Fred requested custody, which he was not granted. Nevertheless, his wife repeatedly accosted Lori, demanding access to Bobby. Lori and Clarabelle and Bobby eventually left Wisconsin and resettled in the Southwest. A few years later, Fred was in jail again, pending trial on charges that he had raped 5 girls and assaulted another so severely that she nearly died. The DA sought 2 life sentences plus 15 years, but he filed paperwork incorrectly, and the case was dismissed. Fred soon moved, and the system lost track of him. "Each time he rapes someone, it's more violent," Lori said, and now he's free. When I met Lori and her family in the trailer park where they were living, Bobby was 12. Lori said she rarely thought about Fred when she looked at Bobby. My sister calls Fred the sperm donor, she related. I believe Bobby's my miracle boy. The rest of her family have also been accepting. My whole family was racist, the older generation, Lori added, but they treated Bobby very special. My great-grandma, she slipped once and called him a nigger. She looked at me and wanted to cry, and she never slipped again. Many of Lori's romantic relationships had been troubled, and Bobby had grown up defending his mother in violent domestic situations. Her work history has also been spotty, in part because she has Social Security income on grounds of PTSD, and if she earns too much money, she'll lose those benefits. So she's worked at Burger King and Taco Bell. But she runs out of steam quickly and finds it hard to deal with other people on the job. The family mostly lives on the income Clarabelle earns at Walmart. Clarabelle had thought the right time to discuss Bobby's origins with him was when he began to ask questions. So when he was 7, Lori told him that she had been raped by his father, who'd put a gun to her head. I don't want to know him, Bobby told me. Good-looking, friendly, and rather self-possessed at 12, Bobby is also high-strung and moody. He has been diagnosed with ADHD and other learning disabilities, possibly inherited from Fred, who was illiterate. One clinician suggested that he may be bipolar as well. He has run into problems with teachers and bounced from school to school. Bobby is the apple of his grandmother's eye. Weekends or early in the morning, Clarabelle said, he comes and sits up on my bed, and I watch National Geographic and nature movies with him. Still, the emotional life of the family remains complicated. I do a lot of hollering, Lori said. I'm in anger management on Tuesday nights. We do family counseling, and I'm on meds till I get back on track. Bobby loses his temper with his friends, and once threw a TV while fighting with his mother. The counselor says he's not going to hit me, Lori says, but he's seen so much violence. 3 days after Lori threw out one of her boyfriends at 5 in the morning for calling Bobby a nigger, she met Ringo Smythe via an online chat room where she was telling a friend about it. Promise me you won't take this guy back, Ringo wrote. She and Bobby met him at the carnival, where he worked the games. Bobby begged his mom to give Ringo a try. When I met Lori, they had been together almost a year, the longest either of them had ever lasted in a romantic relationship. Still, Lori worries given Ringo's background. I come from a convict family, Ringo said. My dad met my mom in a whorehouse, and she did drugs, and I've seen a lot worse stuff on the carnival circuit, so it's pretty hard to freak me out with anything. Ringo broke off midstream, then asked me to hit him hard. I don't feel no pain in my arm, because my dad used my arm as an ashtray. He rolled up his sleeve to show white scars from his shoulder to his wrist. Although Ringo professed not to believe in psychotherapy, he agreed to join the family counseling sessions at which he discussed marrying Lori and adopting Bobby. First, he had to track down the woman to whom he was still married so he could file for a divorce. Both Lori and Ringo were burdened by massive debts. Still, Ringo had made major changes since he and Lori met. I can't stand the heat. I hate trailers. I hate cats, he said. I'm here in Arizona in a trailer park with 5 cats. I asked if that was all for Lori, and he said, yeah, Lori and Bobby both. When I visited, he had taken a leave from the carnival so he wouldn't have to be separated from them, and was working the graveyard shift at Target. I don't think about Fred a lot, But when Ringo does certain sexual things, I have flashbacks, Laurie said. I have bad days and good days, and sometimes the bad days last a week. But we do family things all the time. I would never think of going back to the past and changing anything. I'd have another kid, but not my Bobby. I got my boy. Where did I come from is one of the first urgent questions of childhood. A response that includes terror and powerlessness can undermine a child's feeling of safety. Many rape victims who bear children have to explain why they've had babies at an inappropriate age, in the absence of a stable romantic relationship, or despite lacking financial or emotional resources to provide care for the child. The extent to which a woman feels judged may determine the scope of her concealment or denial. Telling a secure child who isn't looking for answers the story of his or her conception can itself feel like an act of violence. Mothers who are unable to protect themselves are gratified by their ability to protect their children, and shielding them from such awful knowledge is part of that safeguarding. So one mother pledged online, "My son will never know the details of his conception. I don't want him thinking he wasn't wanted or conceived out of love." The withholding of traumatic information is as loaded as the telling. Often the child gleans knowledge accidentally from people on whom it has no direct bearing, then feels betrayed by a lifetime secrecy. In short, there is no good time or safe way to share the news, but concealing it can spell disaster. Holly Van Gulden, an adoption counselor, explained, "Keeping secrets, especially between generations within a family system, implies the material withheld is shameful." To what extent is a mother's choice to spare her child the circumstances of his conception protection, and to what extent is it a dangerous form of denial? Even considered decisions about sharing or withholding fundamental information can have unintended consequences. One man who learned as an adult that he was conceived in rape said the knowledge freed him from seeing his mother as the bad girl or tramp image that is sometimes associated with unwed mothers. The disapproval his mother had sought to evade by harboring her secret had blighted her son's view of her, and by extension of himself. Children easily perceive and absorb humiliation, and if they are the nexus of a parent's shame, they bear it as a heavy weight. To learn that you are the kind of person most mothers would prefer never even to imagine can produce an angry self-doubt similar to that of people with genetic anomalies who believe that selective abortion would invalidate their lives and eradicate their heirs. Some rape-conceived people have become anti-abortion activists as a way of marking the fact that they were born. Lee Ezell, raped by her boss at 18, gave up her daughter Julie for adoption without ever seeing her. 21 years later, Julie found her, and they shared a joyful reunion. "I'm so thankful that the choice was not available in 1963, when Lee could have been so tempted to easily end my life," Julie said. When Lee met her son-in-law, he said, "I want to shake your hand. I want to say thank you for not aborting Julie." Some speak grandiosely about how they evaded abortion, as though they had been wily double agents in utero. They sometimes fail to empathize with the trauma to which they are connected. Sherry Eldridge, conceived in rape and surrendered at birth for adoption, writes of being disappointed when she was reunited with her birth mother 47 years later. As her 10-day visit with her birth mother progressed, their incipient relationship grew strained. Her mother said that the reunion had brought a lot of pain to the surface. "Am I so bad that I would cause her pain?" I kept asking myself, Eldridge writes. At that time, I knew nothing of the horrendous pain a birth mother experiences both at relinquishment and reunion. I was dealing with my own pain and unresolved grief. Eldridge assigns her birth mother's grief solely to separation from her child, with no apparent awareness of the excruciating afterlife of her rape. 4 years, Lisa Boynton thought her most important secret was that she had been abused by her grandfather since she was 5. When Lisa was in 7th grade, she saw a census form on which her father had identified her as stepdaughter. He had never wanted Lisa to know, her mother, Louise, told her, because he was afraid Lisa wouldn't love him anymore. Louise said she'd become pregnant at 15 by a boy from school. I was angry, Lisa said. I'm still angry. My whole family knew that he wasn't my real dad, but no one told me. The following year, Lisa and some friends were hanging out with a friend of theirs, Donnie, who was mentally retarded. Lisa was in 8th grade. Donnie was 20. They had made out a few times, but she never expected it to go further. She went upstairs with him to see something, and he raped her. She screamed, but nobody responded. When she came downstairs shaking and asked her best friend why she hadn't helped her, the friend said, "Oh, I thought you were just getting it, finally. It always hurts the first time." Ironically, only after Lisa's rape, which she kept a secret, did her grandfather's habitual abuse come to light. Her mother overheard her telling a friend about it and prodded her into confessing the whole story. Lisa begged her mother not to tell her stepfather. She said, "Just go to bed. It will be all right." And she must have gone downstairs and told my dad. I heard him throwing things, curses flying out of his mouth. They notified the police. Her stepfather's father pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 5 years on probation. Lisa received a letter of apology from him, but it sounded as though a lawyer wrote it, she said. To me, it meant nothing. Lisa's stepfather cut off relations with his own father. The relationship between Lisa and Louise, despite this energetic support, remained bewilderingly strained. My dad went above and beyond to make me feel that I was loved and part of the family, Lisa said. It was my mother who always blamed me for things. My sister was always innocent. After the rape, Lisa became promiscuous. Like many victims of child sexual abuse, she had no sense of boundaries about physical intimacy. "I would sleep with anybody," she said. "Even though I'd been raped by Donnie, I continued to have sex with him willingly, up until I was in 11th grade. She added, almost in bewilderment, "I guess I'd confused sex with love ever since my grandfather began abusing me." Then one day, when Lisa was 20, Louise confessed that she herself had been raped and that she didn't know who Lisa's father was. The story was eerily similar to Lisa's own. Her mother and her best friend had gone out with 2 older men, and they'd stopped at the men's house. The best friend and one of the men disappeared together, and the other man invited Lisa's mother into another room, where he raped her. Then the first man came in and raped her too. When she learned that she was pregnant, she didn't know which of them was the father. When Lisa pressed her mother for names, Louise gave obviously fictitious ones. "I don't think she's telling me the whole story," Lisa said. "Little things just didn't add up. I couldn't tell her I was angry that she never told me, because I could hear the sadness in her voice. And I never wanted to bring it up again. I'm going to die with a lot of unanswered questions." All the secrets and lies have had a corrosive effect on Lisa, who, in her 30s, still doesn't feel like part of her own family. She has spent a good bit of time looking at online forums that had made her feel less alone. She eventually got a degree in social work, and as a group therapy leader, she counsels women who've experienced similar traumas. Her personal and professional lives are consecrated to recovery. "I minimize my issues and problems," she reflected, "but I'm the first to say, don't minimize yours." She lives with a female partner and has a daughter from a previous relationship to whom she is deeply attached. "I felt like I always had to look out for myself because nobody else is going to look out for me," she said. "I want my daughter's life to be completely different from mine." When we met, Lisa was seeing a therapist she liked, yet she had never discussed the rapes with her therapist. Instead of seeing them as connected, she viewed them as ludicrously coincidental. "I didn't think anyone would believe me," she said to me. "Even to myself, it seems far-fetched that someone could be sexually abused and raped, and then find out my mother was raped, too. The only people who know all the pieces are my mother and my partner, and now you." I wanted to escape the trauma I experienced at my grandfather's hands, and everything that came after that. However, I now know it is something that will always stay with me, and I will not ever fully recover. What I can do is use my experiences to be a better social worker to my clients. I'm able to identify with and relate to them, but in a healthy way, without disclosing my own abuse. Prejudice against rape victims and their children is as real as it is irrational. One blogger wrote, "So many children born out of incest and rape. The CWS, child welfare system, is overwhelmed and underprepared. My suggestion? Put them to sleep like unwanted pets." Even among people with less extreme points of view, prejudice is deeply ingrained. In disdaining and fearing rapists, as most people do, it is only too easy to disdain and fear their progeny. Liberal acquaintances who are all for deaf politics and neurodiversity expressed unease about raising a child with those genes. The innocence of the child is conditional in this domain. To the mother, he is an incarnation of the rape. To the world, he is the rapist's heir. In the face of such bias, a mother may envision her parental relationship as euphoric, either through authentic religious ecstasy or to avoid acknowledging her ambivalence. Catherine DeZeu, in Victims and Victors, says, "It was Patrick, my son, conceived in rape, whose life I had tried to snuff out, who taught me how to forgive. He was willing to forgive not only his biological father, but also me, for physically and verbally abusing him as a child." Another mother, speaking out in the same book, said, "My daughter's identity is in being a child of God. She was the gift that brought me out of fear and darkness into the light of authentic love. The miracle is always twofold, of the child who overcomes his fearsome genes and of the mother who trounces her initial dread. Rhapsody is helpful to both mother and child." One anti-abortionist wrote, "I am the product of rape, and not only rape, but of incest. My mother sacrificed her needs for mine, carried a shame that wasn't hers, and brought a baby into this world that in this day and age probably would not have made it. But she didn't stop there. Being unable to provide me with the things a child needs, like security, food, a roof over my head, schooling, she denied herself the right to keep me, her child. She selflessly let me go for adoption when I was 7. There's an element of will involved in understanding one's own relinquishment as an act of devotion. When she was 3, Tina Gordon called her mother, Mom, and was immediately rebuked. Don't you ever call me that again, Donna said. I'm not your mother. But what am I supposed to call you? Tina asked. You can call me Donna, her mother replied. Tina's great-grandmother told her later, It's not your fault. She was raped when she had you. Tina had no idea what her great-grandmother was talking about. When I learned how to read, I looked it up in the dictionary and understood the violence part but not the sex part, Tina said. For a lot of my life, though, I felt damaged. Tina watched her older sister, Corinna, say, Mom, over and over, and watched her receive at least sporadic flashes of love and attention. I always had to remember that I was the stepchild, so to speak, Tina recalled. The only loving thing her mother ever did for her was to make her sweetened hot milk before bed. Ironically, however, Tina's estrangement from Donna may have afforded her a measure of protection from her mother's destructive tendencies. Donna had had a nervous breakdown in college and was abusive to both Tina and Corinna when they were young. Donna was living in Florida when Tina was born, and a friend called Donna's mother to say that there was a new baby. It might already be too late for the older daughter, the friend said, but you've got to come and get these kids and maybe save this baby. So Tina's grandmother went to fetch the two girls. She found that Corinna was missing parts of her finger pads because Donna had put her hands on the stove as a punishment. Tina and Corinna grew up in Mississippi under the far more loving care of their grandmother, who taught school by day and cleaned houses by night to keep the family going. Donna would visit and say that she was going to reclaim Corinna as soon as she got back on her feet. She made no such promises to Tina, who soon gave up seeking any kind of approval from her mother and focused on her grandmother and aunts, who proved far more reliable. As a result, Tina saw her mother's hypocrisies with greater clarity than her sister did. If we were watching television, Corinna would sit on Donna's lap, and I was just on the floor by myself, Tina said. When Tina was 8 and Corinna was 10, their grandmother died at 58. Donna, close to 40, was clearly unable to handle them both. A great uncle they barely knew felt they shouldn't be split up, and agreed to take them both, so they moved to Connecticut. Aunt Susan and Uncle Thomas gave them material security, but ran an alienating, strict household, and the girls were unhappy. Donna would send care packages and Christmas presents to Corinna, but nothing to Tina. Uncle Thomas told Donna that if she couldn't send presents for both daughters, she shouldn't send anything. After that, there were just letters, cold and formal ones to Tina, effusive ones to Corinna promising to take her back. 2 years after a fire at the house in Connecticut, Corinna was caught trying to set fire to it again, and she was sent to a juvenile facility. Another uncle took her in briefly after she was released, but then she wanted to move back in with Donna. Donna would have none of it, and Corinna was utterly devastated. Aunt Susan and Uncle Thomas weren't willing to have her back. So at 15, she ended up living on the streets in Mississippi. Tina found it painful to be in her uncle's house when Corinna was not allowed to be there, and decided to go to boarding school. I've always just had maybe a little bit of a survivor instinct, Tina said. She was admitted to a girls' school, where she was one of 7 black students in a population of 160. Her aunt and uncle cut her off after she was disciplined for smoking pot. I started to be known at school as the orphan, Tina recalled. Meanwhile, Corinna was hustling and doing drugs. She had developed AIDS by the time Tina started college at New York University. Donna contacted me to disparage Corinna, Tina remembered. I said, I understand why she's made the choices she's made. Other people have had a huge part to play in that. Donna said, What other people? I said, you, and others. That was the end of her trying to reach out to me. The sisters, however, kept in touch.